Hello, and welcome to episode 17 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. My name is Josh Ho. I'm formerly incarcerated. I'm a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Bit of sad news first, Joel has asked to take a sabbatical, so for at least for a little bit, you are stuck with just me. I apologize in advance. I've never done one of these entirely solo, but hopefully it will go okay. So I also want to give a shout out to all our listeners, but especially a group of really dedicated listeners in Japan. It's pretty cool that we've been heard in 22 countries so far, but every single week, a group of people in Japan has been listening with devotion, and I really appreciate it. There's something pretty cool about people all over the world paying attention to the need for radical reimagining of America's criminal justice system here, really appreciate you all listening. Of course, we appreciate all of our listeners. We've had been heard in 49 of the 50 states. I believe North Dakota is now the lone holdout. Anyway, thanks to everyone who's been listening, and we feel free to reach out to us either, you know, through social media. I would love to do, for instance, a mail bag episode where I just answer listener questions. I would love to just get in touch with you. Feel free to follow me on social media on Twitter at my Twitter address is at Joshua B. Ho, and that's H-O-E is the last name. All right. So we've been working our way through prison reform issues, and we started way back at the beginning with kind of grounding this in the need for reform in general, and then working our way from pre-sentencing. We've been working on prison reform, and just last week I did the special episode on the Lee Correctional Riot, which I thought went pretty well. There's been a lot of things happening with that. There was a really good New York Times editorial by Heather Ann Thompson the other day. Hopefully more attention is being brought to the problems in South Carolina. Today I've decided to talk about a campaign that I started recently that I'm calling Bars to Ballots. It's about voting and incarcerated people, but before I go into specifics, let me give you a little bit of context. A few weeks ago, I attended the Democratic Party in Michigan's nominating convention as a delegate. And I thought this was pretty important for a number of reasons, one of which is the symbolic impact of me having attended this convention, because I wasn't representing myself just as a delegate or just as a party member. I was representing myself as a party member and delegate who was formerly incarcerated and is very connected to issues of criminal justice reform and of poverty alleviation. And If you follow me on Twitter, on LinkedIn, or any of the other places that I post social media content, you probably have seen the picture of me holding up, standing right in front of the stage, the main stage at the convention, holding up my lanyard. And the reason for that is because so many people who are formerly incarcerated either cannot vote or have a lot of barriers to voting, and also because a lot of people seemed to have some reluctance to vote. And so it seemed important to me to try and put out there, you know, very publicly that I represent as someone who is formerly incarcerated and does vote, does care about the issues, and will go around and talk to all the candidates. In fact, I talked to, I believe, every possible candidate that was being represented there, at least I talked to their chief of staff, or in many instances, I talked to the candidate themselves. I remember in particular talking to Shri Thanadar twice and talking to a lot of the different. I talked to the mother of one of the Supreme Court justices at one point, which was pretty entertaining. So, you know, why don't people get to vote? Well, in a lot of states in this country, we have in the 14th Amendment, there's a codicil that suggests that states can choose not to allow people to vote who have committed crimes or treason. And so in a lot of states, people have taken the opportunity to mean that prevents or to pass legislation that says that people who are formerly incarcerated can't vote. Luckily, I live in one of the states where the minute you get released from prison or jail, you can vote again. But there are lots of different variations of this. In some states, people can't vote at all. In some states, you can vote, but only under certain conditions. Like depending on the nature of your crime, et cetera. In some places, you can only vote once you get out. I believe in some places, maybe you can vote in jail, but not necessarily in prison. There's a lot of different variations on this. And so I think it's really important, at least from my perspective, to vote whenever I have the chance to vote, because there's so many people who are prevented from doing so. So anyway, I was at this convention, and I was really excited to be there, and I went around and I tried to talk to everybody I could about criminal justice reform and about issues of poverty alleviation. At the end of the convention, we had this big, you know, everyone got in a gigantic room, and we all listened to first about an hour of speeches about why everyone should be excited about being Democrats, why everyone should be ready for what we're calling a blue wave, et cetera. And let me preface this by saying that I don't really, to me, the jacket you wear doesn't really matter that much. I am a lifelong Democrat, but if I was sitting in a situation where one candidate was a libertarian and they really supported criminal justice reform and they were running against a candidate who was a Democrat who really didn't support criminal justice reform, I'm voting for the libertarian. And that's the same if it was a Republican or vice versa, if the Democrat was, you know, so for me, it's a question more about what the content of their positions are. But because of the way the top of the Republican Party has been working lately, I believe that the Democrats are more in tune with my issue agenda. That doesn't mean that I don't have a lot of frustrations with the Democrats, in particular issues, frustration with both poverty alleviation and with criminal justice reform. So we have this big thing. They talk for like an hour about all the things that we need to get excited about. And this happened despite the fact that in about a week in Michigan, a week after the convention, the Senate voted to pass these exceptions to insert into the Medicaid expansion in Michigan work requirements. And it really bothered me that at this convention, where you're supposed to be in tune with, you know, they're at least supposed to be the party, at least, that nobody even mentioned it in an hour of talking about it. And this could be a really fairly devastating bill to a lot of people who are in poverty and a lot of people who are formerly incarcerated. There's a lot of reasons why this is true. It's also kind of strange that this happened. And this is another example, though, of this problem with parties that I'm talking about. In Michigan, at least, this is a GOP-led effort, and all the votes that have happened along party lines, be it in the committee or be it in the legislature so far. And these Medicaid work requirements are the most draconian that have been passed in the entire United States. They require that every single person who is on the Medicaid expansion be able to prove, and that means go to the Department of Health and Human Services and offer proof as to how to guarantee that you worked 29 hours a week. This could be a lot of problems for a lot of people. There's a lot of reasons for that. It's also kind of strange that it happened at all, because about a year before that, the University of Michigan did a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that suggested that the Medicaid expansion had been a boon to Michigan's economy. And that means like $1 billion in revenues created to the state, a lot of benefit in terms of creating employment, a lot of benefit in terms of keeping people who were employed working because they didn't have to worry about, for instance, chronic illnesses and things like that as much because they had health insurance. So the evidence seemed pretty overwhelming that Medicaid as it was in Michigan was working pretty well. Anyway, so they decide to pass this work requirement bill, at least it's passed through the Senate. And you know, it's really also problematic because most people who are on Medicaid actually work. I think it's 67% of people do work, and many of the people who are remaining who don't work because of specific medical conditions. And obviously, if you remove someone's health care because they can't work because of a medical condition, that isn't going to make them work. That's going to make it less likely that they can do anything, much less work. I also really frustrated by this because, you know, I've done a lot of the research into this, and I'll put a lot of this stuff in the links in the show notes. But in the history of putting work requirements into things like Medicaid or welfare or food stamps, we've found that it doesn't really ever do anything positive for the people that you're. So, you know, like in the fantasy world in which this bill is a good idea, the fantasy is that if you put work requirements in, say, Medicaid, that people who are poor will go, oh my goodness, the only way I can have health care is to work. So I'm going to work. Unfortunately, like I said, most people already work. They usually work at jobs that are service jobs, which means that the hours are variable. And because of these work requirements don't necessarily accord to what people's schedules are, they often run afoul of the work requirements and end up not having medical care anymore. And so what I've come to the conclusion of is that most of these bills are really intended to drastically reduce the amount of people who are covered by health insurance, not to actually move people from unemployment into employment, which is what they represent as doing. And I don't think that's none of the research suggests that that's accurate. There's also some pretty good subsequent stuff that suggests that that would not be the effect of these bills. So anyway, it's really frustrating to be at this convention and be around all these people who are supposed to have your back and really be excited to be there and proud to be there and trying to symbolically represent and also trying to get some work done by talking to all of them about criminal justice reform, and then have 6,700 delegates in a room, have everybody talking about everything under the sun that Democrats can do, and not even once have them mention that we need to do something, even one action item for how we could try to stop these Medicaid work requirements that were going to be voted in only a week later, at this gigantic convention. It's totally baffling to me that this wasn't even raised. And then on top of that, they also didn't talk about any criminal justice reform issues. You know, so we have this huge amount of people who are formerly incarcerated, and a huge amount of people who are poor. We've got the Republican Party doing all this work to try to like make it harder. You know, they're at the federal level, they're rolling back food stamps. At the state level, they're putting work requirements in Medicaid. It's not just in Michigan, it's happening all over the country, because at the federal level, the president decided that it would be a good idea to make it possible for these work requirements to be rolled into Medicaid. Now, so we have all this going on, and here we are at this gigantic opportunity with all these people, and nobody's talking about the poverty alleviation, and nobody's talking about criminal justice reform. So it really made me start thinking. I was like, well, why does the Democratic Party? Another thing I want to talk about real quick is I've noticed over the last several years that the Democratic Party doesn't even really like to use the word poverty. They don't like to use the word criminal justice. They don't like to use a lot of these terms. They like to use other euphemisms like hardworking or middle class, but they never say poor. And that's weird, because so many of the people who would likely vote Democrat really technically are poor. And so I started thinking to myself, why is this true? Why is it that the Democrats just won't talk about poverty? They won't talk about clearly important poverty issues. And they're not talking about criminal justice reform, even though, you know, there's all kinds of stuff happening all around the country about it. And I came to some conclusions. The first conclusion is that poor people don't actually vote. As The Guardian put it in 2016, PolitiFact found this. In 2014, about 75% of people who made under $10,000 and about 69% of those who made under $30,000 didn't vote. Or as Daniel C. Belton explained in The Root, it is those who most need representation that are denied it. The reason politicians ignore so many of the working poor is that they don't vote, she writes. And the reason so many of the working poor don't vote is that certain politicians have made sure it is as inconvenient as possible for them. In other words, the politicians have stacked the deck in a lot of ways, and then because they know there'll be no consequences of voting either against or for policies that are tough on poor people, or they feel that there's going to be no cost to voting for against policies that are tough on formerly incarcerated people, they do whatever they want to do. They think it's a losing issue, so they won't talk about it. Obviously, in the case of formerly incarcerated folks, the problems are similar. In many states, formerly incarcerated, as we've mentioned, are not allowed to vote. And in the states where we can vote, often we don't have any political power, you know. So even when we have a criminal justice, we have people listening to us talk about criminal justice reform. They listen, but they don't feel like that we have any people behind us that are backing up our calls for criminal justice reform. And so when push comes to shove, they tend to do things that almost kind of sabotage a lot of the criminal justice reform, or just don't care about it in the first place. It's very frustrating and really made me reflect for a long time. And what I realized is that we really have to start putting people behind our calls for criminal justice reform. We really need to start mobilizing folks to get up and do the work that's necessary to get criminal justice reform done. In other words, we have to start voting our own interests, and we need to start representing at places so the politicians know that no longer are these no-cost votes, that there will be a cost politically if they continue to do things that are designed to hurt criminal justice, people who are criminally justice impacted, or people who are poor. And I keep mentioning poverty because it's a really intersectional community with people who are criminally incarcerated. So many of us face employment discrimination and housing discrimination and all other kinds of discrimination, community discrimination, that it's very hard for us to move our way out of poverty, etc. And so there are a large percentage of the people who are formerly incarcerated who are also poor. So anyway, I came up with this idea for this campaign called Bars to Ballots. And here are the different elements of the campaign that I've come up with so far. The first one, there are approximately 6 to 7 formerly incarcerated people in this country. Another 2 or so million currently incarcerated. Another 2 to 4 million on probation and parole. So somewhere between 12 and 14 million total who have some kind of felony record or have been incarcerated. That give or take a few, and I'll again attach the information I got this from in the show notes. In my opinion, all of those people should have the right to vote. So I'm going to get some pushback where people are going to say, are you saying incarcerated people should have the right to vote? Why should incarcerated people have the right to vote? Well, I have 2 reasons for that. The first reason that I think incarcerated people should have the right to vote is because we operate in a significantly statistically racially imbalanced system. People who are of color are much more likely to be in prison and much more likely as a result of being in prison to have lost their right to vote. As a result of that, when we say that our elections are fair and free and democratic, we're really kind of lying, because the end result of those elections disqualifies a large percentage of the people in this country for being able to vote, which means that that community, those communities are not being represented. So for instance, communities that have a large percentage of formerly incarcerated African-American men in any states where they don't have the right to vote, those counties, when they say their elections are free and fair, are only free and fair if you ignore the fact that people of color can't, a large percentage of people of color can't vote because they're formerly incarcerated. Now, if it's okay with us to say that's what democracy means, well, okay, I mean, I guess I don't know what to say to that. But to me, that's not okay. There's a second reason why I think that incarcerated people should vote, and it's because one of the founding principles of this country is the idea that there should be no taxation without representation. And if formerly incarcerated people have their freedom 100% revoked, that is a form of taxation. In addition, there's a lot of, you know, they spent their whole lives until they were incarcerated paying into the tax system, and now they're losing their ability to have a voice in how they're taxed. And they are taxed not just by the loss of their freedom, but also their communities are taxed because of what's known as prison gerrymandering. We've talked about this a little bit before, but the communities where someone is incarcerated as a result of the census get any of the goodies from the census, as opposed to the communities where those people originally live. So for instance, if I live in a town called Ypsilanti, but I was incarcerated in a place called Jackson, at least for part of my time. And so when I'm in Jackson, and you know, when they do the census, they count me as part of the population of Jackson. But say my family and friends live in Ypsilanti. Well, instead of the goods for my, for you know, anything that would attach to me going to Ypsilanti, it would all go to Jackson, where I was incarcerated. And to me, that's another example of taxation without representation, because especially because the families and friends of incarcerated people often bear a lot of the brunt of the costs of the incarceration. So not only are they not getting the benefits in their local areas, they're also bearing a lot of the costs. So that seems pretty unfair to me as well. Finally, there's a lot of criminal justice debt that gets applied to people when they leave prison or jail, and that is also a form of taxation. And so my opinion is that nobody should ever be taxed without at least having a voice in the process so that democracy can actually represent all of the people who are being taxed. And as you probably remember, that is why we had a Boston Tea Party. That's part of the reasons we had a Revolutionary War. That's part of the core idea of how our democracy works, in my opinion. And so those are reasons why I think probably incarcerated people should vote. But regardless, I think, you know, everybody should vote. And I think that incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people should vote. So the first point of this thing is we need to work to ensure that everybody has the right to vote. The second point is that all of us, and I mean all of us who are formerly incarcerated and do have the right to vote, need to vote. And it would be good if we only voted for candidates who back real criminal justice reform. So what do I mean by real criminal justice reform? So we've talked about this a little bit before. If you remember way back in episode 2, when we talked about the problems of violence, the biggest problem that I had or was talking about in a lot of that episode was the notion of carve-outs into legislation where legislators want to appear to be behind criminal justice reform efforts, but at the same time want to protect themselves from the idea that they're soft on crime. And so what they do is they'll say, pass a bill, like we'll give an example of expungement, which is where you wipe someone's record clean after they, you know, after a certain amount of time that they've been out of prison or jail and have remained offense free. Now, you can put requirements into a bill like that that say only certain people get to experience those benefits. For instance, only people whose crimes were nonviolent, or only people who didn't have a sex offense, or only people who committed a certain types of crimes. You get the idea. The problem with that, and I'll give you the example in expungement, is that a lot of times, by the way they write the language, it sounds good, but it doesn't really help the vast majority of people. For instance, in Michigan, we have an expungement bill, but that expungement bill only covers people who have one felony conviction. And as we talked about in the plea bargaining issue, that's not really the way charging documents work. So they managed to pass a bill that sounds like it's really good criminal justice reform, but it only really affects a small amount of people. For instance, in Detroit, we had an expungement fair where over 200 people showed up and only 8 people, you know, qualified for expungement. And that's pretty typical of how that expungement law works. It really doesn't help many people. So regardless of how long you've stayed offense free, you always remain stuck in the system because of the way the bills work. That's just not... here's another great example from Michigan. Just recently, we were working towards passing a compassionate release bill, and it was a clean bill for a really long time, and it seemed like it was going to pass. And then at the very last second, they added in a bunch of carve-outs, like not people who had committed murder, not people who had sex offenses, not people who had X, Y, and Z. The problem with that is, if you understand compassionate release, it's usually for people who've served a very long sentence and have some kind of chronic disease that prevents them from living a normal life, and probably people who are at the tail end of life and the chronic disease means they're probably going to pass away soon, or they're so incapacitated that being in jail is, you know, just there's no point to it anymore. So who are the people who are most likely to need compassionate release? People who've had long sentences. And who's the most likely people to have long sentences? People who've committed murder. So by putting the carve out in there that nobody who's committed murder can get compassionate release, you've already disqualified most of the people who need compassionate release from compassionate release. So these are examples of how carve outs are used to make things sound like criminal justice reform when really they're not really criminal justice reform. And there's some real dangers with passing what I would call fake criminal justice reform, and with what other people might call, and I think people who push back on this will say, well, you need to have incrementalism. But the problem with, that we can't do it all at once. We have to do it a little bit by a little bit and move on. There's some real dangers with that, though. If you do it incrementally, first of all, you're leaving the vast majority of people behind in most instances. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a bit. Second, many of the people who are involved in passing these bills that have the carve-outs in them assume that after they're done, they've done criminal justice reform, that the job is done, that they can wash their hands, that the system is fixed. Hallelujah! But the problem is, the job isn't done, they haven't fixed most of the problems, and most of the people that need relief don't get it. Finally, unfortunately, even in the same bills, legislators often double down and add even harsher penalties for anyone who's left behind. Okay, this happens all the time because they want to say, look, we're trying to help the good criminals, but not trying to help the bad criminals. In fact, we're going to make it worse for the bad criminals, so you know that our heart's really, I guess, in the right place. You know, in my opinion, by far the wrong place. And so these three things happen over and over again, and that's why our system never gets fixed, really, is because it's all these kind of half measures, most of which also are really regressive. So they sound like criminal justice reform, but they're really regressive. The third thing that we need to do is we need to hold politicians accountable, and we need to represent ourselves to politicians. And we need to do this by making every attempt we can to meet directly with all kinds of people, candidates, politicians, as often as possible, to talk to them and try to get them on the record about what their positions are, and then when elections come around, hold them accountable for what they said. If they didn't do what they said, we need to let people know. If we don't ever show up and we don't ever ask them, they're never going to think that we matter at all, and they're never going to believe that there's a political cost to ignoring our interests. They'll listen to us, they'll smile, they'll try to make us their best friends because they want votes, but they don't think that our votes matter enough or are a danger to them enough because they don't think we have enough numbers. Now, as I mentioned before, there are like 12 to 14 million of us total, and most state elections hinge on a small amount of votes, tens of thousands at most. And if we can start representing and showing up, they're going to have to start paying attention to us. Fourth, we need to make common cause with intersectional groups fighting with us for change. Many formerly incarcerated folks, including me, are poor, for instance. Because there are millions of poor people in every state being silenced, erased, and attacked every day by these things like the work requirements and other things, we should be making common cause and trying to partner with people to try to make sure that we get the most people possible when we're talking about all these issues. I think that's really important. The fifth thing is we really, as a community, as a criminal justice reform community, need to stop limiting the discussion to simply reducing mass incarceration. I am in support of these statements like we should try to reduce mass incarceration by half by 2020, which almost every major organization has some version of this. But the problem is that until we have the numbers to back those calls to action, people are not really going to get on board. They will pass criminal justice reform, but it'll almost always be neutered forms of criminal justice reform. And at the end of the day, unless criminal justice reform addresses so-called violent criminals, and we've talked about that at length before, you are not going to reduce mass incarceration by half by 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, or whatever. You have to have a change of philosophy, and that has to come from politicians. And if those politicians believe there's no cost to being tough on crime, they're never going to stop being tough on crime. If those politicians don't believe there's a cost to being tough on poor people, they're never going to stop being tough on poor people. That means that we have to have both goals and bodies. You know, one of the organizations I admire a bit is Just Leadership USA, because when they did their Close Riker campaign, which has had a lot of effect, even though Rikers isn't closed yet, it's had a lot of effect. But when they did it, they show up with numbers, lots of numbers. And that's what we need to start doing in all of these elections and all of these situations, is showing up and not being silent as much as it's hard. And look, I know a lot of people believe deeply that the political process is corrupted and that you can't get anything good out of politics. And all I'm saying, and maybe that's true, I don't even know. But what I'm saying is, if we stick to these few issues and we unite together and we show up, regardless of how corrupt they are in every other issue, they have to start listening to us because we have numbers. If we use them right now, so, and it's understandable. There's so many barriers to voting. It can be confusing. A lot of times we're discouraged from it. The criminal justice system's pulled us for years and sometimes decades and sometimes multiple decades that we're worthless, that if we stick our head up, they're going to stomp on us. I understand, but the only way that changes is if all of us stand together and start being willing to show up. That's part of the reason also why I keep showing that picture with me with the lanyard. It's not because I like looking at myself. I mean, I have a face for radio. I totally understand that. The reason why I keep holding that lanyard up is to show everybody that we can all represent and we can all stand up for these ideas, and it can make a difference. If I can go talk to every single candidate and get them to talk about criminal justice reform, if I can on this podcast talk to gubernatorial candidates, if I can get audiences with legislators, you can too. And all of us can push for these issues. So finally, what would I say we should all do? I suggest, like I said, making appointments to meet your state representative and senator, to meet with any candidates running for public office in your area of state. And believe me, they always will be willing to meet when they're running for office. You can ask them what, oh, and on the representative and senator, it's very important that you know your representative and your senator, because they will usually only meet with people who are their constituents. You can ask them what their positions are on criminal justice reform and on poverty issues in your state. Get familiar with the pending legislation that could affect you. Show up at all local events discussing these issues. Make sure you tell everyone you meet that you will only vote for candidates who support real criminal justice reform and who support strengthening the social safety net. Help me spread the message. You know, follow me on social media. Use the hashtag bars to ballots. I don't own it. It's just an idea. So it's hashtag BARS, the number 2, BALLOTS. And you can use that anytime you're trying to send out your messaging about why we should all vote. You can follow me on Medium. I'm Josh H. on Medium. Most important, vote, and vote only for candidates who support criminal justice reform and for strengthening the social safety net. All right, well, that was my first try at a solo run without an interview or anything like that. Hope it was okay. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week. Decarceration Nation is available from iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. We are now also available on Spotify. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.